rains came in the wet season, well, that water just went where it wanted to go. It couldn't be absorbed or percolate. And so you had, at the end of the year, massive floods that caused billions of dollars of infrastructure loss. So in a way, that's kind of weather whiplash, where you had dry, dry, dry with forest fires that came right on and burnt the surface, but yet the fires and the drought had nothing to do with the rains falling, the exceptional rains, almost monsoonal rains, falling in the fall, September, October, November of that year, and yet the ground was conditioned not to accept those rains, and you ended up with something like that. There's so many other examples. One that I often speak to when I speak to groups and I talk about, and again, in Manitoba, an agricultural example, you had in 2020, 2021, and 2022, Alec, there were 3 years of growing seasons where there was exactly normal precipitation. You average all those 3 years together, and farmers could say, oh my gosh, this is the best growing season ever. We had exactly the amount of rain that we needed. Not what you got to produce a three-year average right on normal was two of the driest years followed by the wettest. You can't harvest with those kinds of extremes. And so that, in a way, is kind of what I'd call climate whiplash, where you're going from one state of just dry and dry to another state of wet. I mean, you talk to a farmer and they'll say, well, I remember back in 1956, we had the wettest growing season on record. Oh, and the driest, I think that was in 2021. But this is back to back to back. And so I think we're seeing more of that. One other example, an urban example, is the skating on the Rideau Canal in Ottawa. The longest skating rink, outdoor skating rink in the world. And 2 years, for 2 years, in 2023, 2024, there was virtually no skating. You count the number of skating days on your one hand and your fingers. This year, 2025, they had one of the best ever. So we see almost as if we're seeing more and more of this. There's hundreds of examples in every part of the world of this kind of weather whiplash, this fact that you go from one state to another, you can't forecast it, and yet it's really impactful because it's really, you just can't, you know, we always think, well, just we plan based on what we've had, you know. Well, you're going to have something different, and it really causes enormous impacts for people. And a lot of people are relating it to climate change. We're seeing a little bit more of it. I think where it is kind of climate change is that we're seeing that climate change affects, okay, temperatures, precipitation, that. But what it also affects is the atmospheric circulation. We're seeing the jet stream, which is the very important aspect of meteorology, where the cold air to the north, warm air to the south, and a lot of storms hook a ride on the jet stream. So you follow the jet stream, and you kind of know where the weather is. Well, instead of having like zonal kind of jet streams or bungee cord looking jet streams, they are doing more dipping and diving, more like a skipping rope. And so we're seeing these ridges that develop strong and intense and stay put. And that's why we're seeing that heat waves last weeks, not days. And then you're seeing the troughs in that same kind of circulation that are digging in and just bringing periods of rain and stormy weather. And so I think the fact that we're seeing the weather in Canada, for example, has slowed down. It used to take a storm maybe 3 days to go from the west to the east. Now it takes maybe, 4 days or 4.5 days. So the weather has more time to spread its misery. It rains harder and longer, and therefore we're seeing more of the impact. So all affected because of the changes in general circulation brought on by the fact that the world seems to be warmer for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Phillips. He's been the voice of Canadian weather for as long as I've been alive, almost. So look, about 10 years ago, I never heard the term atmospheric river in a nightly newscast or read it in the newspapers. Now atmospheric rivers are taking extraordinary heat right up into Greenland and Antarctica. Do you see this as a growing phenomenon, or are we just becoming more aware of things that have been going on for a long time?
Yeah, That's such a good question, Alex. And, you know, I think there's certain terms in meteorology that are sexy because, you know, people have changed the name of it. I mean, it could be the media. Media is like the polar vortex. My gosh, the polar vortex has been around for centuries. Even El Niño, La Niña. I mean, gosh, it's been around since 1600 when Peruvian fishermen said, oh, my gosh, the warmer waters in the Pacific, that means lousy fishing. Fishing are lower at depths of water where you can't get at them. And so you know, we use these terms, atmospheric rivers, my gosh, you think it's a new thing that's attacking the Pacific coast, whether it be Los Angeles or Vancouver, from storms from Hawaii. Well, that circulation has always been there. Imagine a person said, well, you know, it's almost as much water in the atmosphere as you're seeing in the Amazon River or the St. Lawrence or the Mackenzie. And so in a way, it's kind of like an atmospheric river. And so we see about, my gosh, on average in British Columbia on the West Coast, maybe 25, 30 atmospheric rivers a year. And some are stronger than others. They sometimes want to give them names like atmospheric river 1, 2, 3, 4, like we name hurricanes and tornadoes. I think that sometimes it's just an imaginativeness of meteorologists working the night shift when they come up with these terms. And polar vortex, I mean, used to call it the Arctic pipeline. And so I wouldn't say that all of a sudden we've never seen them before. There's more attention raised to them. The public, instead of just saying cold air from the north, they want to know, is it a polar vortex? So I think it's just kind of a little bit of imagination, but and you know, when you look at some of these things, they do have a more of an occurrence more often sometimes than others. But it's like another one. Let me throw at you, flash drought. I've heard of flash floods, but recently I came across some reference to flash drought, and when I read about it, it made total sense. I mean, it's not sort of a conventional kind of a drought. That, you know, you see it, you sort of see it coming, that you worry about, is this growing season going to be bad like the last two because of drought? Oh, my gosh, yes, there's no rain, we're into a drought. And all of a sudden you become something that's 2 or 3 years long, becomes a decade long, like we've seen in California. And then all of a sudden, I mean, talk about weather whiplash, a drought, and ended with torrential rains that went from fires, houses in Los Angeles burning down, to then sliding off the slope because of landslides and mudslides because of too much to water. So a flash drought is kind of interesting in the sense you almost are in it and you're not sure it is a drought. Like, and typically occurs in the hot time of the year, July and August. You've had maybe some precipitation. You've then really filled the soil moisture back up to the levels you want. Last year was a good year because you had a good amount of rain. But then all of a sudden, you get to a situation where, oh my gosh, the temperature is really warmed up. It's sucking all that moisture out of the ground. The evaporation is taking place. The transpiration is taking place. And all of a sudden, you see the plants wilting, and you're into a drought situation before you knew it, and you can't do anything about it. So that word flash drought is becoming now. Flash droughts, only about 5 or 10% of the flash droughts lead to what we call conventional drought. It's an episode that occurs. It causes problems for farmers and water managers and forest firefighters, but it's just an example of the fact that, hey, when we look at these things, we want to give better definitions and better examples of them, and so that's why we sometimes use these words to help us understand them and distinguish them from other similar situations.
I've been tracking climate media for about 35 years, and I remember when meteorologists and their official associations were reluctant to discuss climate change at all. Some TV weather people, particularly in the United States, hardly ever mentioned it. Do you see a kind of evolution of weather science now as it gets closer to climate science and vice versa?
Well, I really do. You know, I mean, scientists are always reluctant to get involved in the political or the side of things. They feel that their job is to look at the science, to better understand the science, and provide good numbers, good evidence for politicians or economists or people who are who are in a position to do something about it. I always say that, you know, climate change science is easy. Deciding what to do about it is much more challenging. But I think that really meteorologists, on-air meteorologists, weather broadcasters, were always a little bit reluctant to go that point because they had sort of, see, they know the difference between weather and climate. It's like a farmer. You know, I speak to a lot of farmers. They don't always believe what I say about climate change. I think the younger ones do, the ones that have gotten to some science and that. But they've seen so much weather in their lifetime that it's hard to convince them that this is different than what it was in other years. And yet I always learn from them that they're growing crops their parents would only dream of, which I said, well, there's evidence that you're seeing a change of climate. And they're also seeing more extremes that beat them up in storms that occur or heavier amounts of rain that lead to flooding and situations like that. So I tell them, well, that what they're seeing is they're living the climate change. They're living the predictions of the past, and that really is climate change. And it's why it's different than when you were just starting out in that area. But certainly, I think the media, meteorologists or weather broadcasters have been reluctant. They seem to be coming on more and more now. They recognize, and why that is, I think, Alec, is because the public has accepted it. I mean, we've looked at polling, and we've found that 70% of Canadians believe that the climate has changed and that human beings have had something to do with it. That's a remarkable change from what it was just a decade or so ago. And not only that the vast majority of Canadians, again, 65-70% of Canadians believe that weather is more extreme now because of climate change. And I've always felt that when you look out the window, you can't see climate, you can see weather. But really, when we see that weather out there, it's bigger and badder and more impactful because of what we have done to it, that we've warmed it up. And when you warm up the atmosphere, every degree of warming says that the atmosphere can hold 7 to 12% more moisture. So that rainstorm that you get in Montreal is 30 years ago is going to be, you know, anywhere from, you know, 25 to 40% more, have more moisture available to rain on you. And so I think that Canadians, weather broadcasters, are seeing that more and more. But to think, though, Alec, and not to raise a political issue, to think that, you know, I get kids who write to me and want to know, how do we become climatologists? They used to be, wanted to be meteorologists, forecasters, storm chasers. Now they say, what kind of education do you need to be a climatologist? And to think in the United States, if you're a climatologist, you could be fired. And I think this just saddens me greatly. Great work that people have done who are dedicated. They're not trying to push their thoughts on it. They just want the truth, and they work on science to deliver that. And to think that their value is not appreciated anymore. In fact, it's almost as if they're shunted because of the valuable work that they're doing, I think is an incredibly unfortunate situation.
Yeah, weather forecasting depends a lot on American satellites and government data. Does Canada have enough equipment to accurately forecast the weather without American sources?
Well, I think one of the great stories of humanity is the fact the sharing of meteorological data from countries around the world. Countries could be at war with each other, but they're still trading sharing their weather information because of the good work of the World Meteorological Organization, which is a UN agency. And so I think people recognize the weather doesn't stop at the border, and you need storms that are occurring or events that are occurring in the other side of the world can affect the weather in your place. So your forecasts are going to be bigger, and they're going to be better, more accurate, more timely, more credible if you've got this incredible pool of data from around the world, from meteorological balloons, from satellites, from radar. And yes, it's sharing that information is important. The United States are very important, and they've had quite a great service to the world in providing that information free of charge, available to those who want it. And I think that I worry sometimes whether that standard will be lessened in the years to come. I hope not, because, say, I mean, something could be happening in the Amazon rainforest that could affect storms in Atlantic Canada. And so we need to know that information and share it. And one of the great, I think, success stories of science and really of civilization has been the fact that we better observe the world now. I think certainly computers have helped and radar and satellites, but the fact that we observe planet Earth, the oceans can't burp without us knowing about it now. And I think that has made people around the world safer and better off. I think I can remember, Alex, that back in 1971-72, there was a terrible storm that occurred in Bangladesh, a tropical storm, killed over 300,000 people. And I just how terrible that was to read that. Now, if 100 people die from a storm, it's so much worse. But we now know, because of meteorology, because of better emergency measures, the value of life that people have, that the world is better off now than it ever has been. And there are fewer people dying from weather now than there was 100 years ago. And I think that is a great accomplishment and something that we should be proud of. But that is certainly comes from the fact that we're observing the world better and we're sharing that information for everybody, no matter what their political state is.
But just to press the point, could Canada accurately forecast the weather if American sources are not available to us for any reason?
Well, I mean, I think we can for sure. I mean, I think it's, hell, we were forecasting the weather not too long ago by just wetting our finger and throwing up chalk in the air. But no, I mean, we certainly depend upon all of the radar and the satellites and the supercomputers and the data. Certainly, the more data we have, the better off our forecast will be. It's a slow process. You know, people say to me, well, gee, you can put a person on the moon. Why can't you forecast tomorrow's precipitation better? Well, I mean, people's demands and expectations for weather are much higher now than they were in the past. I mean, my gosh, people said to me when I began my career over, you know, 50 years ago, they'd say, well, it's going to rain tomorrow in Toronto. And now they want to know, it's going to rain in North York after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, exactly when it's going to end and how much rain and how hard is it going to be. I mean, our expectations from weather people have increased dramatically, and yet we've improved. But, you know, the improvement is very slow. We often say that our performance our increases on an average of 1 day every 10 years. So our 5-day forecast 20 years ago is as accurate as our 7-day forecast is today. And so that's with all the bells and whistles that we have. The supercomputer, the largest computer in Canada, is for the Weather Service. And so it really takes a lot of skill and men and women and machinery and eyes in the sky to do that. I mean, I just, it's hard for me to express what the difference would be in our accuracy of our forecast if we didn't have the satellites and the radar. I mean, we have, you know, we have European satellites that we could use, the Japanese, and have the American satellite. That would be an incredible loss, but it would mean that we would just have to maybe do it a little differently in some ways. The error rate might be a little higher, but hey, Canadians would certainly get their forecast every day that they depend upon it now. They would still have that in the future if something to the United States went to drastic means. And I certainly think there's no talk of that. I mean, it's a matter of, it's just unthinkable that would happen, because it would affect the accuracy of Americans, and that I think they would be not right to do.
Well, these are the times when the unthinkable happens tomorrow.
Well, that's true. Unfortunately, we've seen that. Who would have thought we would have had what we see today just a short, 6 months ago? So, you're right. I mean, we have to prepare for sometimes what we don't want to, but have certainly you can't put all of your eggs in the one basket. You've got to have different ways. That's why we have different models, different Canadian models. We have European models, and we issue them, and we have to say something, and some are more skillful than others. And the other thing is you always learn from it. That's the beauty of meteorology, and is that you're always learning from your past experience, and And hopefully that makes you a better forecaster in the years to come.
From Ontario, Canada, we've been speaking with the voice of Canadian Weather and Environment, David Phillips. Find links to the stories we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, it's been great to talk in person, and thank you for spending time with us.
Well, Alex, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much, and it was a lot of fun. I wasn't sure what would happen, but thank you very much for taking me and allowing me to share some of my thoughts with your great listeners.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
January 2017. Haven't I seen this movie before?
Human society in times of climate change is like a sinking boat taking on water. The crowds will rush from one side to the other. As we know, sometimes that causes the ship to tip, throwing everyone into the sea. Right now in America and Australia, and perhaps soon in the UK or Europe, the captains try to say there is no problem. Donald Trump denies that climate change is happening. It's a hoax, he says, as he appoints fossil fuel people to regulate the environment, science, and energy. Of course, the physics of the melting ice world, the heating oceans and rising seas, don't care what he thinks. According to a Florida risk analysis agency, by the year 2045, Trump's so-called winter White House, called Mar-a-Lago, will be underwater 210 days a year. Maybe humans will make it a special dive site where you can visit and remember the American president who made the dumbest mistake in the world. That drowned resort will be a gold-plated monument to climate change denial. He'll be dead, of course, and so will millions of others, but that temple of excess under the sea will be a signal of the legacy of Donald Trump. At dozens of military bases, the American forces face the same problems of rising seas and more intense storm surges. Later in this program, we'll hear from Erica Spanger Siegfried at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She led a comprehensive report into the coming challenges to military bases as climate change unfolds. But first, we'll talk to a medical genius who can explain how and why denial is so easy to trigger in human beings. I'm Alex Smith. Here's this week's serving of Need to Know Information from Radio EcoShock. After decades of great science showing how climate change operates, we get an incoming American administration composed of climate science deniers. How is that possible? A listener suggested I contact Ajit Varkey about his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. So now we're in for a treat. We'll spend a little time with an awe-inspiring professor of medicine and pioneer researcher from the University of California in San Diego. Following his beginning in India, Ajit Varkey has led American explorations into cellular and molecular medicine. His multifaceted mind also ventures into the origins of humans and, as it turns out, a critical mechanism of human consciousness. Understand the role of denial, says Varkey, and you understand a lot about your own life and the civilization around us. Ajit Varkey, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Your meeting with Danny Brower and this book on denial shows to me that advances can be almost accidental or serendipitous, at least. Tell us about Danny Brower.
Yeah, that's really a case of serendipity in science. I, as you mentioned, mostly study cellular and molecular medicine and cellular and molecular differences between humans and other species. But once in a while, I venture into sort of less familiar territory such as psychology and so on. And when you do that, you're guaranteed somebody would come and give them your opinion, their opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion about the human mind. And so I sat down for lunch at the University of Arizona in 2005 after giving a lecture, and this bearded man sat next to me and said, "You're all asking the wrong question." And then I realized he was the chair of cell biology, Danny Brower, and he gave me this fascinating idea. I'd never thought about it before. And I suggested to Danny that he should write this up. And we sat there for an hour and a half after everybody's gone talking about it. And but then I never heard from him again. And then a year later, I tried to contact him, still got no response. And I finally looked him up on the internet and found his obituary. And so not knowing what to do, since he had not published his basic idea, I wrote a letter to the journal Nature along with my own embellishments of his idea and extensions. And that was published in 2009, I believe. And shortly thereafter, I was contacted by his widow, who said, Sharon Brow, who said, thank you so much. Can you please finish Danny's book? And so I ended up with Danny's incomplete manuscript and done something I'd never done before, write a book with a man I'd met only for an hour and a half and who's no longer with us.
That is amazing. Well, let's get to the essential theory that you and Danny propose. Why do we humans need denial as a function of our intelligence?
So let's step back and acknowledge, I think you will, everybody will, it's not just climate change. We deny anything we don't like. You know, I study the mechanism by which red meat increases the risk of cancer and heart attacks, and yet 80% of the people in my lab eat red meat. And we could go on and on, right, whether it be exercise, national debt, different levels of denial, but we're all in some form of denial or the other. So it's a very peculiar human characteristic, and it's never really been explained. There are many discussions about this, you know, different names for it, cognitive dissonance, other kinds of words used in different books written about this general phenomenon. But why would we end up with something like that? And that was the question that Danny approached in a new way. And the basic question he asked was something that I'd never thought about. You know, people like me have been looking for a long time to say, what made us human? What was that cognitive leap, or what were the series of genetic and biological changes that made it possible for us to, say, you know, run a radio station or whatever? And when you think about that, you assume that it was just natural selection gradually, you know, selecting for an improved mind. And Danny said you should not be asking that question. We've got birds, we've got elephants, we've got dolphins, we've got whales, we've got chimpanzees. I just described 200 million years or more of evolution where we had many, many smart, warm-blooded, social, complex, intelligent creatures. So he said you should not be asking what made us human. You should be asking what stopped everybody else. Why aren't we competing with a human-like elephant or a human-like dolphin or a human-like crow? Why is just one of us was one species taking over the planet? So that was the sort of counterintuitive idea he put in my head, which I'd never heard before.
And what is that barrier? I mean, what happened? It sounds from my reading of your book that a double leap happened.
Right. So after thinking about it further and I realized that I coined a term in the book, a psychological evolutionary barrier. So we've all heard of physiological evolutionary barriers. For example, going from water to land, that's not easy and wasn't done many times. And you can't just, you know, walk out onto land and start living. You've got to have many things work just right. So it's a barrier. And there have been many such barriers in evolution that have been surpassed by complex processes of evolution. But when you have a barrier, many things have to go just right at the right time in order to break the barrier, as opposed to just gradual, you know, improvement by natural selection. So this psychological evolutionary barrier that Danny was positing has to do with something we must begin with, self-awareness. Now, all of the species I just mentioned, crows, corvid birds, elephants, dolphins, etc., can recognize themselves in a mirror. This kind of study has been done to varying extents, most convincingly in chimpanzees. They know who they are, just as we know who we are. So they would be like a 2 to 3 year old child who can recognize himself or herself in the mirror. So that's pretty close to where we are, after all. And more recently, it's been shown that they even begin to understand the minds of others. But this is the critical step.
Genius medical researcher Ajit Varkey on his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs and the Origins of the Human Mind. The full interview was broadcast on January 11, 2017. Find a link in my show blog. Thank you for listening.